I need to recognize my two co-authors, and Ryan Olmos is a doctor to me. He's working on his dissertation, and then Dr. Michael Thompson. So all the hard questions that you may have should go to them. Of course, I come from the side of the field mice with dirty boots, working in the field and trying to get some recommendations for farmers out there. So my perspective is coming from that side. You see, I get to the edge of the interlayers of the micas, but I don't get inside. And some of you are inside those interlayers, and it's tough to get outside. So I think it's great, this type of symposium that we put people together. Soil testing in crop production, well, this is something basic for many of us. Often there are several tests for a nutrient. Some are more appropriate than others for soil with contrasting soil properties. We have known for at least 110 years that we need research to select the best test for different soils of a region with contrasting soil properties. Be potassium, nitrogen, K, doesn't matter what. A soil test result is meaningless without a proper field calibration with yield response. And I'm very strong about this in spite of all these big data things that people are talking about. Of course, they will solve everything with big data. Different tests may measure different amounts, and values for a test may have different meanings for different soils, different sampling times, and sample handling. So when we talk about giving a meaning to a soil test result, we're talking about field calibration, okay? That's what we have to do, you know, to understand what do we do with the soil test results. And there are two portions of that. I'm not going in depth, you know, but I think it's important to understand. Field correlation relates test values to crop response across many site years, okay? So we have to determine the critical concentrations or ranges, establish interpretation classes for crops, and the treatments here can be just a control or a non-limiting rate. See? That's what we are after. For the field calibration, it's different, you know, because we need to, if there is a deficiency, we need to find what are the rates that we get to some fraction of the maximum yield, 90%, maximum economic yield, whatever it is, for different soil test values. And for this, we need, again, many trials, many years, you know, things like that, but also several application rates. So what I will be emphasizing mostly in this talk is the field correlation stuff. And this is important because there are important things for the calibration too. There is more uncertainty for soil potassium testing and prediction of crop response than for pea. That's very obvious. I started working on pea back in Uruguay in South America in 1975, and then now I'm working in P&K here since 1993. There is higher temporal and spatial variability. There are complex exchange equilibrium or kinetics between soil K pools, moisture issues in the field and in the lab, the potassium recycling from residues and rainfall. We have just a paper coming up and a couple of former students here work with that. But also, we have the issue of the induced K deficiency, even with high testing soils that apparently have plenty of potassium, you know. And we have all this effect that we have known for 100 years. Dry, wet, compacted, or loose soil affect that root damage by insects or diseases or things like that. You know, we have known that for decades. In a way, I feel that we are discovering America again. Many of the things that we are talking about. Okay, so these factors affect in different ways the correlation portion, okay, the calibration, so two different things, the interpretations, and the fertilizer management. Now we could talk hours about each of these things, but I will not, don't worry about it. So I have to give you a short story of Iowa soil K testing, because there has been lots of research there, and again, seems that we are discovering America again. There was very extensive basic and applied research in the 50s and 70s in Iowa and also regional. The problem with some of the research at the time, of course it's easy to talk about the old timers that most are gone or retiring, is that they have the lab mice were here, the field mice were here, they really often didn't talk to each other. And we are not even doing that now, and this is a great step towards that. You know, we are doing some other things. So, and this is not, this is my opinion of what I learned when I go to Iowa in 1993, that there were minor mineralogy or exchangeable, non-exchangeable issues in row crop areas, okay, of Iowa and the Western Corn Belt. Some very old data, who knows where the numbers are, indicated that we need lower K rates for the small areas of sandy soil that is in Iowa and Illinois, that they are ignored by research. You know, it's not worth to spend money there from a practical perspective, you know, because they're very small areas. The subsoil properties and the subsoil potassium levels in PAPs, there's a history in Iowa about that. Apparently, they found, yes, using stepwise regression, that when I hear those words, I start shaking and get goosebumps. We need, of course, meta-analysis will solve all that. That we needed lower critical concentrations or potassium rates for soil series with high subsoil potassium. So they implemented in the 60s different interpretations depending on the subsoil K in Iowa. Well, after 20 years of research in Iowa last year, I dropped all that because I cannot justify it. Really, I can't. So we took it out for our, I was so nervous about doing that, you know, because it was a 40 years history, but really we cannot justify it. So what about the traditional view of soil mineralogy in Iowa? Here, Mike, don't die of a heart attack, but this is something that I talk with you, that in Iowa dominated by smectites, whatever that means, there is all kinds, 60-70%, the remaining includes some mica and kaolinite, and sometimes there are very small amounts of vermiculite. So, Iowa is important. We produce 12% of the corn and soybean in the United States and all the stuff, you know, but the mineralogy is really apparently in row crop areas, which is three quarters of Iowa, apparently it's not much variation. However, since we started this work, Mike Thompson and Ryan Allman say, hey, seems that we have a little bit more variability than that in mineralogy. So at that time, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there was regional research on sample drying because there was this large project, you know, mostly greenhouse, you know, and lab, a few in the field in Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and other states. And apparently they showed that the potassium testing of field moist samples was a better predictor of yield response. We have been saying for 170 years that the ideal is that the soil should be tested as is, not drying to change some things. Well, okay. Now, that affected potassium, but didn't affect calcium, magnesium, sodium, or phosphorus. Doesn't matter what method you use. So there, in 1963, my senior peers in Iowa, they implemented a field moist test that was used until 88. It was recommended, one of the recommended methods in the NCR 13 methods books for the North Central region. They correlated the ammonium acid extractant, there was no Melic 3 at that time there, with crop response. Now what happened? In 88 I was a student, and this is the one I think the worst mistake that Iowa State has done in soil fertility. No lab adopted this test, so let's just drop it. And they dropped it at the end of 88, and they started just doing the other one. When I talked to some of the old timers why the labs didn't use it, because complicated handling procedures. So when I started working in the early 90s in Iowa, everybody would say, well, Antonio will fail, you know, because we already know everything about phosphorus and potassium. What the heck is going to do that is new? Well, so when I was looking at potassium placement and phosphorus placement, I found that some of the interpretation that we have for potassium were not working. So until 2001, I worked each of these points as an experiment. So this is an early field correlation that we work in Iowa, and these are extremely much worse than any correlation for phosphorus that I have seen. And I've seen data from Minnesota, from Indiana, it's about the same thing. So essentially, yes, we can get to a level above which the probability of response is very small, but below that, the predictive capacity of the soil test to predict a response is essentially zero. That's the problem we have, okay, for corn and for soybean, seems that it's worse than corn. Then there were three long-term experiments that I inherited, and So until the year 14, they were doing the moist test. There were four rates applied every year. And then there was an impasse there when John Webb retired and I came on board. And then we started doing the dry. That was the moist test was used in Iowa anymore. So you don't need to be a PhD or an expert in meta-analysis to see that when they changed the dry, it was a heck of a mess. Okay, there's no doubt about it. And in the three experiments, that's what happened. The three long-term experiments. So I say, what's going on? I thought we knew everything about potassium. So I had to work with the soil sampling handling again. So from 2001, 2006, this was published in 2012 because my Pedro Barbagelata went to Argentina and never wrote the papers. Finally, I got to work on it on Sundays and Saturday. We published in 2012. We had 362 site years over 5 years across 32 soil series in Iowa. Several of the soil series, of course, they are in neighboring states. So we field correlated the dry and moist test with the ammonium acid of the Melick. We also field correlated the quick sodium tetraphenyl boron test for so-called non-exchangeable K that Cox and Jordan and others proposed by in the late 90s. I call it that it measures the most reactive non-exchangeable K. Who knows what that means in terms of the soil chemists. Then we look at K reversion. We pretreated dry soil with water or octanol. Wow, we went back to the 60s. Here we go again. And some of this was published. Others still waiting in the thesis folders to be published. This is just an example of some of the things we did with the pre-treating, because some labs were saying, hey, that's easier than handling more samples. Well, it doesn't work. Here are just correlations. I'm not showing the calibration with the correlation with response, but essentially rewetting partially approximated a bit more what the moist test is, but it's not the same. And then the octanol was a disaster. The octanol tend to open some of those layers. So we look at all kinds of things, okay? Correlations, multiple regression, CC, not very basic measurements. We look at the potassium saturation, organic matter, pH, all the stuff across all these. No, we didn't do meta-analysis. You know, yeah, I guess that solved this problem, but anyway, we didn't use it. So the only thing we found is that made some sense is that the internal drainage of the soil made a difference. So if you look here on the figure on the left, we have, this is soybean. We have the correlation with the dry common test, and I just put interpretation classes that we have until 2012. Now we change them. And you see it's kind of a mess. Now it seems that the dark points, we have a higher response here. I don't have a pointer here. And it seems that they are clustered about here. Then we have the moderate here. Of course, I could show regression and coefficient, things like that. But when we go to the moist test, it's obvious you need to be a PhD to know that these correlations here with field response is better than that. It's not all about it. It's not perfect, not as good as the phosphorus one, but we have kind of this curvilinear response shape that we should expect. As I said, no pH, all texture, all the stuff didn't explain much. It was apparently the drainage. So this is corn, it's the same thing. So we also look at, okay, what are the factors that explain better the difference between the moist and the dry? And there was one that came, other than apparently the drainage, is the soil test cake level that we can see. And now we have almost as many numbers now. Seems that when we are at about 200 parts per million, 150 to 200 parts per million or milligrams per kilo, of moist test, is that after that there is not much different. We have more numbers now, and actually it can go down. See, at those high levels, say we get higher testing with the moist than with the dry. And then soil moisture that I thought would explain more, soil moisture at the time of the sampling, yeah, is what you expect. There is small differences, you know, when the soil is kind of dry, but it's not really a good correlation. So When we work on that, we say, okay, and what? This is essentially the same thing that they have done, except now I have a trillion of field response trials in order to show that the MOIT test worked. So now I need to go and convince the lab. So we essentially slept on it, you know, because the IPNI said, Antonio, we help you, you know. I mean, if you now you have the response data that before they didn't have. Now what happened? There was a big change in 2012. Some guys that didn't have a clue about SOIL, they were PhDs from Stanford physics. They came up, you know, for reasons long to explain. So they came up with the idea of having these machines, you know, in order to do the slurry test. They opened a lab in Iowa, and over 3 months, they are analyzing now 100,000 samples per year. So I said, hey, so the MOIT test for K is back to life. So then we started working on it. So we have this more field correlation 2011-2013. We found the same thing. The MOIT test was now included in the North Central region chapter. Four labs now operating in the Midwest are offering the MOIT test either as a default or as optional to do it. Iowa State University put back with new interpretations the MOIT test in 2013. And by the way, we also updated the interpretation for the common dry test. You know, now several people told me, Antonio, why don't you just drop the dry test? It's a piece of crap that doesn't work. Just go with the MOIT. I said, I can do that, you know, because there are 15 labs operating in Iowa, you know, and not everybody's changed, so we need to do it. Okay. So now let's go back a little bit, some new research, some ongoing research. Pedro Barbagelata, back in 2003, in a subset of the samples, got this information. Drying temperature, air dry, 40 degrees, 35 to 40 is what we recommend, and then you have 13 at least, in order to dry the soil, 50 degrees. And these are typical soil series of Iowa and the Western Corn Belt. For many of you, it doesn't make any sense. But just I put there the texture, this is the median texture, silty clay loam, whatever. And then if they are lost soils or till, glacier till, you know, with high calcium, whatever, colluvium, etc. So you can see, no wonder that the dry test doesn't work. When you go across different soils, there is a major difference in the potassium extracted. So how would any correlation with field response will work? It's obvious that it's not going to work, at least in our condition. Okay? Now, there was some work in Minnesota. This was unpublished. Part of the NCL 13, Roger Elias and George Rehm, 2003, they try again, you know, half field capacity, air dry, 120 Fahrenheit, sorry about the units, air dry with air with dry and wet cycles, and they extracted K with ammonium acetate, malic 3, barium acetate, magnesium acetate, and then they have two soils. This capacitance sandy loam that I don't have a clue what the mineralogy is done. And the canisteo that we have them in Iowa too. So we see that the extractant didn't do much, but there is a major difference based on the sandy soil or the other soil. I know I need to hurry up. So this is the same thing that we have, and I put the mineralogy. This is a very hot day that just came last week from Ryan Olmos and Michael Thompson. So what do we explain? Okay, we have the vermiculite, very small. We have smectites, tend to dominate, and kaolinite in some. But when we look at where there is a major change by drying, we have this western and canisteo with very little vermiculite, lots of smectite, the galva silty clay loam, which has the largest proportion of vermiculite than the others, but still small, and then this mahaska, you know, that has, again, smectite and kaolinite. So we started scratching our heads, and but then I put there the drainage. So here we have poorly drained, moderate to well drained, and somewhat poor drainage. And here we have well drained or moderate drainage. So when I go back to here, what I can see is, well, it may be this vermiculite and the smectite, larger proportion, in combination with the drainage. I don't know. But then we have two examples. We have this galva silty clay loam, low soil, and western. We apply 180 pounds of K2O before corn. We measure soil decay, ammonium acetate, bromelic, the same thing, after harvest. And then we measure the removal. So this is what we did. This is what you would expect with 180 pounds of K2O. It's much more than removal. There should be an increase after harvest, okay? We went to this Webster poorly drained. We didn't increase at all the soil decay after harvest, okay? Yes, the level was a bit higher here than here, but not that much higher. The removal didn't explain that. So now I just the same thing. I just put the mineralogy and the drainage. This is the moderately well drained, poorly drained, the vermiculate here, the smectite dominating. I'm scratching my head. I'm not sure what Michael thinks. But now we have the comparison for some rates. We didn't have money to look at the tetrafenil boron extraction in all the rates. When we are in this galva soil, yeah, here I put again the soil test scale. And this is relative increase, so we can compare the two sides. I know the soil test scale level may affect it, but it wasn't much different, 180, 110. The non-exchangeable K, that didn't change anything between the treatments after harvest. But in the other soil, here was the K. So the potassium was not in the soil decay, it was in the non-exchangeable fraction. But you know what? When we put soybean the following year, there wasn't a response in any of both. The soybean saw that so-called non-exchangeable K. Okay? But we are not measuring it. Here is the mineralogy again. How do we explain that, Michael? Ryan Olmatz will explain by the end of next year. So, this is just work in progress. I really hate the name non-exchangeable K. I really hate the name fixed K. I'm sorry. In my opinion, you guys understand what that means. But we use those terms with agronomists out there. They don't have a clue. I think that we should start talking like the fossils. See, we don't talk about fixation anymore. It took 50 years after Stan Butler said that he didn't like the word fossil fixation to stop using it. By not working together, we are confusing things out there, even in the terminology of things. That's my opinion. So, we need better understanding. So we have these two graduate students doing great work while Mike and I relax. We have new field crop response trials in Iowa, dry moss testing, sampling time, moisture, the mineralogy of clay and fine seed or fine sand, I don't remember, Michael. Slowly exchangeable K. I'm not going to talk about non-exchangeable K again in my life. Short-term retention and release, yes. Fixation, no. Short-term retention and release. How this fixation, guys, that we are mentioning, what it has to do with the long-term work happening in the field. I'm sorry. Somebody may want to burn me on stake, but these things are creating lots of confusion out there. Incubations, contrasting soil, more from Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and different K levels, dry and moist testing, the mineralogy of the clay and fine sealed, K retention and release, okay, all these indices that we have, and then hopefully understand something about the redox and the moisture regime. And with that, I don't know if I'm too over or not.